Hey everyone, before this episode of Still Loading on Soul Calibur 2 begins, I just wanted to give a quick disclaimer. My guest and I, Jay, we talk about EVO, and this happened before EVO was canceled. EVO 2020 was canceled. So we talk about how it's moving to all online and what they're thinking it's going to do in terms of, you know, network connection and all this, and input delay and all that other stuff. And, it's never happened. It didn't happen. It got canceled. So just wanted to give that disclaimer up front, and with that said, on with the show. On this episode of Still Loading, a tale of souls and swords, eternally retold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. This is the summer of PS2, and actually, according to my notes, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is the 9th episode of the summer of PS2, and this is the second episode in what is kind of like a fighting game series. Last week was Dragon Ball Z Budokai. This week, we are talking Soul Calibur 2, and with me to talk about Soul Calibur 2 is my friend Jay. Jay, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to talk about one of my favorite games of all time.
You are the only guest I would have for any Soul Calibur episode, mainly because you are a competitive Soul Calibur player. You play the newest one, though, correct?
Well, as of right now, yeah. I started playing competitively Soul Calibur 4 related in Soul Calibur 4, so that's about 2008, so we're talking about 12 years now.
They're up to 6 now or 7?
Yeah.
6.
Yeah,
6. 6.
There's a pretty big lull in between 5 and 6. That's why the numbers haven't gone up as quickly as you might hope.
What do you think of 6 so far? I know this is not relating to 2, but I'm just curious. I don't think I got to ask you much. I remember when it came out, you set aside a day to play it and set aside a good amount of time to tinker around with it. But now that you've had a long time with it, what do you think of it?
As a competitive game or just overall in terms of enjoyment?
Both.
So in terms of enjoyment, there's plenty of stuff to get excited about. I definitely appreciate the game on that side of the scale. As a competitive game, I definitely liked previous versions significantly more. It's a lot easier to get into this game than previous iterations, so it definitely has that going for it.
Oh, that's good then. That's good. Now, we're here to talk about Soul Calibur 2.
Mm-hmm.
And as a competitive Soul Calibur player, like I said, I thought you were the perfect person to talk to about this. And I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, what do you know about the competitive world of Soul Calibur 2? I know you said you had to talk to one of your friends who played Soul Calibur 2 professionally, I believe, mm-hmm. right?
Not necessarily professionally, because we didn't have professionals at that time of okay. in the iterations of Soul Calibur, but competitively, yes.
So What is it like competitively? What about this game? I guess Soul Calibur in general, what makes it different from other fighting games? Let's start with that, and then let's dive into the Soul Calibur 2 competitive scene.
Well, when it comes to Soul Calibur as opposed to other, what one would consider to be more traditional fighters in America, which would be predominantly things like Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, stuff like that.
Tekken.
And Tekken, you know, especially too. Tekken and Soul Calibur are both made by the same company, Namco, and they are 3D games as opposed to 2D games. So right off the bat, that does provide significantly more complexity and different options that your opponents have. And the other thing to also mention is, in things like Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, when you are knocked down, you effectively have, at best, you can do one of two options. You either get up quickly or you get up slowly. And then when you are through the animation of getting up, your character is invincible, right? But mm-hmm. there are these two set timings, and you're just going to get up off of the ground. That is very much not the case in Namco games. In Namco games, there is no invulnerability when you're getting up. Hitboxes might, certain frames and certain graphics might change for your character, which would make it a little bit harder to hit.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is, you are still vulnerable as you're getting up, which I always liked a lot better. And on top of that, there are so many different... You can roll on the ground. You can stay on the ground for a lot longer than you want to. You can tech up off of the ground. There are so many... It's so much more dynamic in terms of how the game can be played when it comes to this whole, like, waking up kind of situation. So that really kind of separates Namco games from other fighting games.
And Tekken is like that too, with the non-invulnerability as you're getting up?
Yeah, both like the Namco fighting games, Tekken and Soul Calibur, are very similar in the sense of the wake-up kind of situation and the fact that they are 3D as opposed to 2D. Now, what I would say separates Soul Calibur from Tekken, primarily just in terms of like the first thing that you're going to notice, Soul Calibur characters use weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Tekken characters predominantly don't use weapons. In fact, the only character who does is Yoshimitsu, who is also a Soul Calibur character.
Okay, so there's some cross... I mean, I guess it makes sense. Are there universes connected, Tekken and Soul Calibur?
Yes.
Okay, I did not know that. But
by Yoshimitsu. As far as I know, but if you know Namco games just in general, Yoshimitsu has been in almost every Tekken and every Soul Calibur. Not all of them, but almost. And the main thing to note about him is that he's always very, obviously he is effectively a character. Everybody who has played either version of Tekken or Soul Calibur is going to know his whole shtiel. In terms of the lore, Yoshimitsu isn't actually the name of the guy. It's the name of the sword.
Okay.
So the idea is, whomever is wielding Yoshimitsu becomes Yoshimitsu. So, Tekken is supposed to take place in the future. Soul Calibur takes place in, like, the late 1500s. The person that you are playing as in Soul Calibur 4 and previous would be the first Yoshimitsu. That is Yoshimitsu the First. And then, once you get to Soul Calibur 5, you're dealing with Yoshimitsu the Second. In fact, he even calls himself Yoshimitsu the Second. And when you select him on the character select screen, you can see the character's, like, you know, the character portrait, it's him effectively standing, like, having his hand on the first Yoshimitsu's corpse. So it's obvious that he killed the initial Yoshimitsu, because they're all part of a tribe. And then once you get to Tekken, you're dealing with, a bionic Yoshimitsu the 40th or something like that. So the universes are effectively connected in that way, which is kind of just like a little bit of flavor. It doesn't really have any like anchoring aspects of the game either way.
Okay. So then in terms of a competitive game, how does it differ from, I guess not how does it differ from, I mean, what's it like as a competitive game? What is it? What's different about it? What is similar about it? Like that kind of thing.
When it comes to how Soul Calibur might be different than Tekken, Tekken has significantly larger combos. Tekken is the combo game. For the most part, the majority of the characters have a variety of different launchers and setups that give you this gigantic combo. And you have, like, you hit somebody onto the wall, and then you have, like, wall combos and stuff. Now, the wall combo part of it does exist in Soul Calibur, but for the most part, as a generalized idea, the combos in that game are not very large. Soul Calibur does not really hit. Soul Calibur, at the most, will generally have 2 to 3 hit combos, and anything more than that is pretty different than, like, Tekken, which would have 10 to 12 to 15 hit combos.
Okay.
And then also, another main thing is, again, you do have wall combos, but in Soul Calibur, you can also ring your opponent out. There will be parts of the stage. In fact, one of the major differences between the initial Soul Calibur, also known as Soul Edge,
I was actually going to talk about this. Go on.
Yeah, and Soul Calibur 2 is that it effectively introduced the concept of walls. Before that, in the initial game, every single stage, and it was always something that made me laugh when I was a kid, every single stage was essentially the exact same kind of thing, which was a triangle out in space. It was essentially
Final Destination from Smash or something.
A floating plateau out in the middle of like a bayou or like a tomb or something like that. But it was all like completely open. There were no walls, meaning you had certain moves that every character had mm-hmm. that would push the opponent out of the ring. And so understanding stage positioning is very, very, and that state to this day is very, very important in Soul Calibur. You need to understand what your opponent's options are to potentially ring you out of the ring, because if you get rung out, you just lost that round. It doesn't matter whether you had full life or not. That's just the end. And so knowing what options your opponent has to kind of create that situation and how to mitigate those potential disasters is really the best way to play Soul Calibur.
That makes sense, because I was watching a long play of it, and one of the cool things about Soul Calibur 2, I think they do it in 1 as well, but was Link in the first Soul Calibur game?
No.
That's what I thought. He was in the second one, but only on GameCube, if I remember correctly.
That's right. Soul Calibur was released on Xbox, PS2, and GameCube, and each
Soul Calibur 2, you mean?
That's right. And each, depending on which console you got it on, it would have a different guest character. For GameCube, Link is the GameCube version of the guest character for Soul Calibur 2.
Do you know what it is for PS2 and for Heihachi. Xbox?
And Xbox is Spawn.
What is it for PS2? Heihachi? Is that what you said?
Yep.
Tekken character. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's kind of drop out, but I guess. But, yeah.
It is a little bit eye-rolly, but at the same time, they went to such lengths to get a completely Nintendo-owned character in Link, so I'm willing to bet they wanted to take a bit of a break.
Understandably so. Well, in just the long play I was watching, it was the GameCube version, so Link was in it. And there was one section of the game that they were playing, because it was, you know, they were playing through the story mode,
uh-huh.
which we'll get to the story in a little bit, but there was one fight specifically where they just purposely ringed out everyone. Like they would position themselves on the edge and then wait so they could grapple the enemy and then throw them off. Obviously against a human player that wouldn't work, or a professional player that wouldn't work, but you know, with AI you can easily manipulate it.
In terms of a human, you might be surprised at how easy it is to ring people out, but the problem is that just makes people upset.
I'm talking about professional players. I'm an awful fighting game player. How does Soul Calibur 2 differ from the others? Like, is it, like, in general, I guess with Soul Calibur, I know we're kind of talking about Soul Calibur as a nebulous topic, but, like,
mm-hmm.
how does Soul Calibur 2 differ from the others in terms of its mechanics? Like, obviously, the walls was a big addition from the first game where you couldn't get ring, like, there. Like maybe some levels had walls all the way around it, so you couldn't get any ring outs. But the one I was watching, 3 out of the 4 sides had walls, and the 4th one you could get ring outs, or maybe 2 out of the 4 sides, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But other than the walls, like how does it differ from like 3 or 1? Is there any more technical differences, or is it just obviously the big one's the walls? But is there anything more than that?
Maybe not necessarily large mechanical discoveries. Soul Calibur 2 is also what introduced the Clash system, as far as I'm aware.
I did look that up too.
Yeah, meaning two different, both of the characters effectively have an active button going on at the exact same time, and that creates some sort of like a pushback, and potentially you're going to get like a higher priority system depending on which move is clashing with what. And then you also have situations where if you were to compare Soul Calibur 2 to the more long kind of games, 3, 4, and 5 and stuff like that, they've essentially taken what Soul Calibur 2 had and kind of built off of it. So for instance, I don't believe Soul Calibur 2 had breakable walls that would effectively, you could get one hit off of the wall, your opponent would, like, you push them onto the wall, and then they would be in that kind of hit stun so that you could mm-hmm. get the combo, but now the wall is away. So if you're 100% prepared for that, you go from a wall combo into a ring out. And so it creates a little bit more of a dynamic in that kind of a situation. Soul Calibur 2, in terms of the single player kind of stuff, Soul Calibur 3 still had this kind of stuff, but it had a pretty extensive version of effectively a single player mode, which was pretty nice for somebody like me who grew up kind of like an only child. So I had plenty of time on my hands where I was just kind of interacting with nobody, and being able to just pour so much time into getting all the bonus attacks or getting all the bonus weapons and all the bonus characters and all the demonstrations and all that kind of stuff was actually pretty fun. Definitely a bore now because I actually have a life, but before, you know, back then, hey, you know, I've got all this time on my hands. I might as well do something with it.
I mean, I think I've talked to you about this, like, you know, when we've hung out and stuff like that. But in general, like, you always, when you're playing games as a kid, you always find, like, how did I do stuff? Like, how did I do this as a kid? Like, I don't have the patience for this now. And I think I'm with you in the sense, like, we just had time. It's not even that we had nothing better to do. So we just kept doing it. We didn't know there was anything better to do in a weird sense.
That's not even just necessarily a video games kind of thing. One has more time the younger you are. And I'd be willing to bet that the 40s and 50-year-old versions of each other would say the same thing about us now. That,
I totally thought you said virgins. I was like, hey, now, I'm married.
Hey-o.
But no, you're probably right. Probably 40 and 50 year old versions of, especially with everything that's going on right now. We're recording this about like this episode is coming out on August 16th. So
were we ever so young,
and we're recording this over 3 months in advance. This is May. So who knows? It could be a completely different world in August when this comes out. And we're
the
recording
murder
this
hornets
in the midst
will
have finally of the lockdown.
Us.
What?
The murder hornets would have finally gotten us.
I know, right? So maybe it never comes out. But we definitely have so much. We had so much more time as a kid, so we could like push ourselves through this. So in regards, since you're talking about the single player, I don't know about the single player in the first game, but at least what I saw in this game. And normally, I like to go in order when I talk about games. I always like to, when I cover games on the podcast, I always like to go, all right, let's talk about the first game first, second game second, you know, so on and so forth.
Right.
But because this is the summer of PS2, and I asked all my previous guests, because the last time you were on, it was, I think it's been almost 2 years now, actually.
Probably something like that, yeah.
I asked all my previous guests, like, what would be something you want to talk about? And you suggested this one. I'm like, I have to do this, like, especially because I don't have like fighting games out of every genre of game is probably the one I am least familiar with and weakest at, but also one that I'm fascinated by the community around it, and not fascinated in like a shitty way. Like, it's nothing but respect. It's just like, it's so cool to me to see the community around this, because it is so, it's like, I don't find enjoyment out of fighting games, but I love the fact that so many people do. If it's a really weird, like, it's like I want to so bad, but I just don't, because I'm bad at them, and I don't enjoy it enough to keep pushing myself to actually become good at it.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, because I've always, even since before Soul Calibur 2, has always been kind of my thing. I have always found the It sounds very schmaltzy, but the aesthetics and of movement that fighting games provide you to really kind of improvised choreography in terms of how the players are matching up with their characters and against each other has always been the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life.
I love that you have that passion about it, because one of the things I focus on the podcast, obviously, is nostalgia. And nostalgia is all about the passion for stuff that you experienced beforehand. It doesn't even have to necessarily even be, like, from your childhood. Like, I have nostalgia for Minecraft because I remember when I was still living with my parents, I would put on Scrubs and play Minecraft to, like, fucking 4 in the morning. And I don't do that anymore. I don't have time for it. But I don't even think I was in college. I think I had just gotten out of college, and I was still working on trying to find a full-time job at the time. So I had a bunch more free time. But
I think it would have been really funny if you had said, like, so, yeah, I don't do that anymore because, you know, Scrubs isn't on the air anymore, so I can't do that as much.
Dude, it wasn't even on the air. This was a totally legally downloaded version. And I had that on repeat, and I just, you know, watching through the whole series. I would literally put the episodes on random and just pick it, like, watch a random episode and laugh at it and ordered Pizza Hut, which now my stomach doesn't necessarily always like, depending on how dehydrated I am at the time. But
I like the idea of you having all the episodes at your disposal, and like, so every single day it's like you're picking out a wine for dinner, just like, which episode looks good today? I like,
dude,
that idea.
I there's who is it? We've talked about it before, the James Bonding podcast, right?
Matt Gourley.
Yeah, Matt Gourley. Did you hear his story of like what he would do when he was in his like mid-20s? I don't know if we I actually talked about this on stream one time, but he tells a story about how when he was in his mid-20s, he was just done with like everything. Like, he not like suicidal, but just like he was just mentally worn out.
Exhausted.
So
yeah.
he was financially well off enough that he took a month off from everything, quit his job, just took a month off from all commitments. He wanted to go a full month with no commitments whatsoever. So, I mean, this sounds amazing to me. First off, I would probably get stir crazy after like a day, but I digress.
I'd be amazingly fine.
So what he did is that he would wake up, he would like sleep in, go to the same bar for a corned beef sandwich, Guinness, and a deep fried Snickers, and he would read a James Bond book while, like, one of the Ian Fleming novels while he was there, and he would, you know, spend a couple hours there just, you know, sipping on his Guinness, eating its food and reading a book. Then he would go home, pick a James Bond movie off his shelf, kind of like, you know, choose which wine you want to thing, and he would watch one every day for like a full month. And that just sounds like heaven to me. It doesn't even have to be James Bond, but just the idea of like having, he still kept a routine, but it was just a routine of just stuff that he enjoyed. Now, admittedly, a deep fried Snickers probably isn't the healthiest thing for you.
But having that level of agency over your life, yeah, it's hard not to find that enticing.
Oh my gosh, it just sounds awesome. Like, it just sounds so comforting. I mean, I would love to do that, but knowing me, I'd probably go stir crazy after a little bit. But and I think he said he still hung out with friends. Like, it wasn't like he was just a hermit, but who knows. Right. Anyway, so back to what we were talking about Soul Calibur.
It's true, yes.
That is the topic of this episode. So what I did see for the single player, because I wanted to talk about the single player a little bit, was that I did see this one seemed to have like RPG mechanics to an extent. Like, you could pick and choose different weapons, and then your characters could level up.
Very, very limited extent, but yes, that is true. You would effectively level up by putting yourself through a variety of unique challenges. This is one of the things that, looking back on it, seems the most hilarious to me in terms of the different challenges that Soul Calibur 2 would provide you in terms of like a single player kind of mode, because they would do things that no other version of Soul Calibur like did before or has since. Stuff like the stage that you're fighting on is quicksand, meaning if you just stand there, then your character is eventually just going to fall into the ground, and they just do progressively, so you have to keep moving. You have to keep going, which is
weird. It's like
weird.
The floor is lava, but
yeah, it's kind of like that. My favorite one, and the one that's always been a running joke with my friends and I, is it would give you a description of what you're about to go into right before you started like fighting, and the one of them was rats bite at your feet.
Okay.
So the idea is every once in a while when you're fighting and playing Soul Calibur, a rat would just bite at your feet, and then your character would be like in the middle of a combo and then just like fall on the ground because he bit at his feet. So just every once in a while neither of the fighters would think, hey, maybe we should fight somewhere else. So it's where these things aren't around, and they're just like, oh no, and then you just fall down.
Like, why would... I just don't understand the logic of like, this is a good game design mechanic that people will love this.
Yeah. And well, I mean, it stayed with me for this amount of time, so I guess that's a version of love.
Just because it stayed with you doesn't mean that it was good. I mean, you can remember things that are bad, too.
But you can't love something until you hate something, so maybe they were trying to help out with that.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I love stuff without having to hate it sometimes, a lot of times.
Yeah, but you know what hating something is like, though. And so maybe Namco was like, hey, what if we give kids the first introduction of hating things, and that way they'll love things in the future.
Oh, so you're talking about like not hating something so much that until you love it, it's literally using that as a juxtaposition. Like, now you know what hate is, therefore you can love the things you love even more.
Exactly. Like, what is the concept of good without evil?
It's a measurement of hate.
Yeah, what is black without white? What is yin without yang? So it's a very Japanese way of looking at the world, you know?
Oh my god. It's such a... All right, fair. You know what? I'll accept it. Let's roll that.
Okay.
That's canon.
I appreciate it.
But okay, so the story, the single player goes through the story of the game, and the story of Soul Calibur, of all fighting games, I find to be the most bizarre combination of complex as hell but simplistic as shit.
Yeah.
And it's so strange to me that, like, how much of it happened. So with Soul Calibur 2, like, looking at the plot, according to what Wikipedia says, so I want you to let me know if any of this is correct, because, you know,
okay,
it's Wikipedia.
Right.
The game is set in the year 1590, 4 years after the events of Soul Calibur 1. The wave of slaughters that terrorized Europe reached a sudden end. The knight in azure armor, Nightmare, and his followers were successful in collecting enough souls and were about to start the restoring ceremony on the ruins of the once proud Ostrinsburg Castle.
Yeah.
And what they're talking about, for all the listeners who don't know, because I didn't know before I researched for this, is a lot of the lore around Soul Calibur is that there's an evil sword called the Soul's Edge, and it's a legendary sword that a lot of people think is for the good. It's like, they think it's going to do good things, but in actuality, the sword itself is evil, and it corrupts people who use it, kind of like the ring from Lord of the Rings.
They did not necessarily think that it was going to do good things. They weren't getting it to do good. They were getting it to be powerful. They knew that it was not necessarily going to be doing very good things, but they all wanted it for one reason, either to stop somebody else from getting it, or they wanted it for some other means of power.
Well, and then the counterpart to Soul Edge, or is it, yeah, Soul Edge. I wasn't sure if it was Soul's Edge, but no.
No.
The counterpoint to Soul Edge is Soul Calibur, which is the holy sword, the good sword to combat the evil sword. I did do a little research as to how, like, Soul Edge was created out of basically a bunch of people getting killed.
Yeah, very FMA, right?
And a bunch of people getting killed in, like, the chaos created it or something like that. It's born of chaos. And then,
yeah, astral chaos. Yeah.
And then in terms of, then Soul Calibur is like, oh wow, there's essentially the universe is like, there's this evil sword. Well, you gotta have yin. I can't speak.
Right.
You gotta have yin and yang. So here's Soul Calibur.
And that's why they gave us really shitty game modes in Soul Calibur 2.
Like,
welcome,
what?
Everyone. Like, rats bite at your feet.
Okay, there you go. You gotta have yin and yang.
Yeah.
It all comes together. It's a full
It all
circle.
Comes together, and that's
full
the whole
circle.
Point.
So, pretty much, from it goes, says, but the ceremony was... But just as the ceremony was about to start, three young warriors assaulted the castle. After an intense battle, Nightmare fell, but then the evil soul inside of Soul Edge sent the young warriors into a vortex of hellfire and stood to confront them. As a result of Soul Edge's evil aura, Krita Yuga revealed its true form. I don't know what Krita Yuga is. Oh.
Kali Yuga.
Wait, what?
Kali Yuga.
Kali Yuga?
Yep.
Well, it says K-R-I-T-A.
Well, la-di-da.
So it's Kali Yuga?
Yeah.
I'll trust you over Wikipedia.
That's Killick's weapon. He's the, one could argue is a, as a protagonist of Soul Calibur.
So he turns into Soul Calibur. It reveals its true form, that of the Holy Sword, Soul Calibur. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The intense battle ended with a victory of the Holy Sword, but at the collapse of the Vortex of Inferno, both swords, along with the Azure Nightmare, was sucked into a void and expelled in another place. Siegfried, you know, totally fits in with the names here. Siegfried, years later, the Azure Knight Nightmare returned. Wait, hold on. That sentence doesn't make sense.
What's that?
It says Siegfried, years later, the Azure Knight Nightmare returned. Siegfried a person or a place?
Siegfried and Nightmare are the same person.
Okay, because that's not explained in this.
It's assumed that it's assumed that you would know that from Soul Calibur. So Soul Calibur, the initial game, had Siegfried as a character. And then if you follow the storyline of that, it's very much kind of like the One Ring in Lord of the Rings, as you were saying. Siegfried is the person who got Soul Edge, and then Soul Edge corrupted him into Nightmare.
Okay, and what I did see, like, his one arm looks like this blighted monstrosity.
Yeah.
And it's like his right arm is just like, it looks like it's been turned into stone, and it's got, like, mountains all over it. And every time he goes into a battle, he just says, "I need more souls," or something like that.
He is effectively what would classically be considered just a monster.
Okay. So yeah, so Siegfried returns later as the Azure, as Nightmare, but as the evil version. So it's almost like he was his old self, and then he became Nightmare again.
Yeah.
Around those times, various warriors came into contact with the Blade's remaining fragments, revealing Soul Edge's ultimate survival after its defeat. Driven either to possess or to destroy it, they join in a new journey while Nightmare begins his rampage, seeking souls to restore the Soul Edge once again. And that's where it ends.
Yep.
Is that pretty much like the epilogue setting up Soul Calibur 3?
You could effectively call it that. So, like, the idea of Soul Calibur 2 is that everything that you're playing is a ramp up to that final battle that you're talking about that happens at Alstrinsburg.
In the Hellfire Vortex.
Well, that's at the very, very culmination of it, yes. But at Alstrinsburg, where they're trying to create the final form of Soul Edge, Alstrinsburg is the castle and the hometown of Siegfried. And so Siegfried, with a handful of the other characters that are playable, Astaroth, Lizard Man, Ivy, they effectively form this this final four, if you will, who are collecting souls to make Soul Edge a lot stronger. And then you have the good guys bust in, and you've got Maxi, the pirate who's a Bruce Lee knockoff with the nunchucks.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Killick, who has the staff, and you have Zhang Hua, who has who ends up being the wielder of Soul Calibur to beat the spirit of Soul Edge, also known as Inferno.
Okay, so that storyline, actually, as ridiculous as it is to read it, it's kind of cool that it's that, like, everything that led up in Soul Calibur 1, this is the final battle that was meant to be in Soul Calibur 1, type of thing, in terms of the story.
Yeah, so, I feel like out of the storylines of every iteration of Soul Calibur, Soul Calibur 2 is really good in the sense of, if you really cared about story, which if you did, you wouldn't be playing a fighting game, it still has a storyline that is as concise as it could be. It has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a conclusion of sorts. So at least there's that to a certain degree, you know?
I would agree. And like overall, like for the plot of a game, like it's weird. It's very much like the way they're kind of doing it, I think, makes sense for the style of game. It's, you have an overarching story, but the overarching story would essentially, like, it's not like it's a trilogy of movies or anything like that. It's like if you had a trilogy of movies, the story of, like, the first three games all takes place over, like, the one movie or something like that. I don't know the story of the third game, but essentially, like, if you thought of a movie, you know, you would have them working their way up through the castle and then fighting the final boss. Well, they just split that story into two different games. Working their way to the castle is the first game, and then the castle and the big baddie is the second game. So they just took a movie and split it into two different games, essentially, in terms of plot.
Yeah, you can kind of argue it that way. All three of the main characters, the positive ones, Maxi, Killick, and Zhang Hua, all effectively have their final fight. They all have storylines that kind of center around the bad guy that they're going to fight. Maxi, the guy with nunchucks, fights Astaroth, the hulking Goliath with an axe. And there's this whole backstory as to why they're going to be fighting. There's a way that Astaroth has effectively wronged Maxi. And then you have Killick, who's effectively the main character, is going to fight Nightmare. And by the time that fight is finished, Zhang Hua is going to go into Astral Chaos and beat Inferno using Soul Calibur simply because Nightmare is defeated and Killick is simply too damaged and too exhausted from the battle itself. So there are effectively all these little lines of this last fight. And one of my favorite parts of the storyline at the end of Soul Calibur 2, remember us talking about Yoshimitsu and how the character like crosses Tekken and Soul Calibur and everything like that?
Yeah.
He comes to Ostrandsburg as well. And he gets there about 15 minutes too late. And when he shows up, everybody's dead. And so he just leaves. He's like, well,
so that's how they really missed the boat here.
The
Tekken character, they just had him show up. Like, he didn't affect the story at all. He just kind of shows up. He's like, oh, all right.
Yeah, that happens.
That's pretty funny.
There's a lot of characters that are, you could argue, are like ancillary type characters that either would become more important in later games in terms of the story, like Raphael, or are kind of side characters just in general, like Mitsurugi.
Let's kind of dive into the characters then now, or let's dive into the characters now then, because we've talked about the story. I mean, I don't think there's much more to really talk about it. It's a pretty simplistic story. Would you agree?
You can talk about individual character storylines, but if you want to do that, then you'd have to give me at least 4 or 5 hours to talk about
that
kind of
stuff. Yeah, I don't think...
And I feel like that's not necessarily the best use of our time.
No, I would agree.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk now about the different characters' fighting styles and just stuff like that. Like, what's unique about the different characters in terms of a competitive sense? And because, I mean, obviously in terms of regular gameplay, they would have... they're different too, but I feel like as a competitive player, you would know the details much better, and it would obviously be that much more of a important difference for competitive players because you have to know this stuff. But real quick, before we go into that, just a little fun fact that I did look up for this. In the Korean versions of Soul Calibur 1 and 2, they replaced the character Mitsurugi with a new character named Arthur.
Yeah.
And who is a Caucasian and dresses like a samurai. And the most likely it's because Korea and Japan didn't get along, or generally didn't get along because of World War II and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And Korea actively discouraged samurai imagery and references, so Mitsurugi wasn't allowed into it. He was eventually added into Soul Calibur in Korea, replacing Arthur, but there apparently are still nods to Arthur seen in later entries. I thought that was kind of interesting. The one they mentioned was that the series, even outside of Korea, has his trademark eye patch appear as a costume in the series.
Yep.
In the creative fighter mode. So they do kind of have small little nods here and there. I thought that was kind of an interesting fun fact. I always find localization differences interesting to me.
It is also important to note that, like, in terms of the storyline, there are a handful of Korean fighters, and they always lose.
Oh, no.
Like, in terms of the storyline, they always lose all of their fights.
That's them showing their hand a little bit. I guess there's no love lost between either of them.
Yeah, a little like stretch of your collar, like, okay. I feel like a message is being sent here.
That's kind of funny. But anyway, so what are some of the differences between the characters in terms of competitive sense? Like, how do they, like, what are some... I mean, I guess some technical differences, you know, like, I don't know, really know how to phrase the question, but I guess that makes sense with what I asked so far.
So, one of the things that that kind of hinges on a question that you had asked me earlier in terms of what sets Soul Calibur apart from other fighting games is the fact that characters... I'm only speculating here, but the fact that characters in this game have weapons as opposed to just fighting hand-to-hand for the most part, I believe gives them a bigger advantage when it comes to creating a personality for the character through the aesthetics of their fighting style. So, you know, if you take a more classic kind of fighter from America, like Street Fighter, you have personalities in fighting styles. You have the grappler like Zangief, you have, like, you know, the normal hero like Ken or Ryu that's more like well-rounded, and you have really fast characters, right? But then if you take a look at Zangief, who's supposed to be a grappler and is much bigger than every other character, yeah, he does have these higher damage and slower moves, but he still has effectively like a jab. He has a jab that and this is just my opinion, so anybody who listens to this who doesn't agree with it, that's totally fine. But I find he has a jab that looks unnatural for him. It looks like something like, oh, the reason why he has that is because he's a character in Street Fighter, and to be a character in Street Fighter, you have to have a tool like this. And that's just how it is. But in Soul Calibur, the grapple hulking brute of a guy version in Soul Calibur is Astaroth. Now, every character effectively has a jab where they just crouch down a little bit and they just swing their sword. For Astaroth, who has an axe that's twice as big as some of the characters are in this game just in general, when he does his jab, it looks clunky. It looks ridiculously slow. He looks very awkward when he does it. It's clear that this is not his natural happy space when it comes to fighting. His happy space is throwing his body at you. He rams you. He grabs you. It's a lot of I am aware as Astaroth that 10 times out of 10, when I'm fighting somebody, I am the biggest thing in the room. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to prove it to you when I fight you. Another very big example of this is the versions of the game that have Siegfried and Nightmare as playable characters. Remember how I said that they were both the same person, and they Yes. effectively have the same weapon? So they effectively have the same weapon, which is that, I can't remember the name of it, Zweihandler? The weapon that's supposed to take out a man on his horse all in one swing, you know, that gigantic kind of sword.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're talking about something that is massive, right? So you take somebody like Siegfried, who is a human, who is a person. And when you see Siegfried fight with this gigantic sword, he uses techniques. He puts it behind his back. He puts it on top of his head. He will, like, use it in a variety of different ways and different stances to wield this gigantic thing in a way that makes sense for a human being. Makes sense a little bit more than something
else. Yes, because he's more human, so he has to actually... There's some limitations to it.
Worry about the weight, worry about the balance, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Now you take somebody like Nightmare. Now Nightmare is evil incarnate. He is effectively like a conjuration of evil. He doesn't have to worry about any stuff like that. So one of the main differences that you're going to see is that Nightmare wields that sword normally with one hand. He just wields it around. And when he's wielding it around, he has stances and everything, but they're a much more aggressive kind of style, where he doesn't have to worry about potentially losing his balance or succumbing to the weight of his weapon. He just swings it around. He swings it around to the point, and if the opponent tries to block it, yeah, they're going to be able to block it, but they're going to be in significantly more stun from just recovering from after blocking it, because he's swinging it so much more violently, so much more aggressively. So even though the characters are effectively what we would call in Soul Calibur mimic characters, where it's like, Namco kind of got lazy, and they effectively just created the same character twice, and they're playing it off as two different characters. You can kind of see the same thing in Smash Brothers, where they effectively have, like, the same character twice in a variety of different ways. Yeah. Mario, Dr. Mario, stuff like that. But I really feel like the personalities of the characters really get brought out with the fact that they're wielding weapons, because and the fact that Namco, as opposed to stuff like Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, give the characters so many moves. There are so many moves, which can be kind of a drag when you're trying to learn the game, but is so much fun when you can see all the different things that the characters have at their disposal.
Okay. So with those personality traits that you're talking about, how do you translate that into fighting when you're playing in a competitive scenario? What do you have to keep in mind depending on which character you're fighting against? Obviously, the player that you're fighting against, you have to know a little bit about them and their tendencies, but how does the individual character and their moveset change what you're going to do?
So, at that point, it is much more like a traditional kind of fighter archetype idea, where you have, so for instance, I talked about Astaroth being the biggest guy in the room, and he is a grappler. It is reasonable to expect, any time that you're playing against Astaroth, that you're going to have to deal with a lot of grabs, because he's a gigantic guy, he gets a lot more damage off of grabs than any other character, and his grab range is significantly longer than other people.
Because he's huge.
To be expected, a bigger guy's going to have a bigger reach, right? Now you take somebody like Raphael, a character that was introduced in Soul Calibur 2. He uses a rapier. He is effectively his storyline is effectively being a fencing expert. This guy isn't going to do a lot of damage, because he's constantly poking you with effectively like a needle, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to wear the opponent down with a variety of really fast and very small, tight movements to wear the character out. So he's going to be hitting buttons and is going to be attacking an Astaroth player easily in amounts of 10 to 1. He's going to constantly be hitting Astaroth, and Astaroth potentially going to get frustrated. Meanwhile, the Astaroth player will know, all I got to do is get this one hit. Just as long as I get this one swing, it's going to equal the same amount as if I just got hit 10 times. And so, economy of movement, economy of buttons, depending on which character you're playing.
Okay. Would you say in fighting game, in like when you're playing in a competitive scenario, I was listening to another podcast, Warp World, which mm-hmm. has a bunch of different streamers on it. The one guy, Xwater, was talking about this, and he was saying how, like, the moment you become emotionally invested in a fight is the moment you lose. Not necessarily, like, obviously you want to win, like, you're that type of emotionally invested, but the moment you start wanting to be like, oh, I'm going to get him back for that hit, or I'm going to get him or her back for this attack,
oh,
or
sure.
this grapple.
Yeah.
Like, that's the moment where you lose, because then all of a sudden you're just going, you're blindly swinging versus keeping your calm and reflecting on it. Is there any is there any characters that are better for that type of mentality? Because that would be my strategy. I just get angry and then I just swing.
In terms of one could argue that all characters are good at beating that, and all characters are good at being that, because that's much more of an aspect of human nature. And I wouldn't necessarily put it in those words, but I think I understand what he's getting at, in the sense of, the second, so I would normally take it as a more academic approach to interpreting that idea, in the sense of, when it is clear that you've made it clear in the game with the way that you're moving your character that you are irritated with how I am playing, it makes you significantly easier to beat. Especially in this game where you have so many options in terms of leading your opponent to bad situations that are going to get them in more trouble, and what we would call whiff punishing, meaning the player has now done an attack, but I am way too far out of range, so there's going to be this amount of time where they're recovering from that whiffed attack, right?
Yeah.
And in that time, as long as I get a hit out there, I can basically hit you with whatever I want, right? And so constantly, and this kind of goes to what a fighting game player would call spacing. The idea of and you can kind of see this in real fights, in real life as well, to a lesser extent. You can imagine, once you get used to how the opponent's character moves and attacks, that they effectively have this bubble around them, this force where you know that even though this character is not necessarily attacking right here, right now, at this moment, there is this sphere of influence where the second that they press a button, they will be able to create a hitbox, which is like a square within the field of battle, mm-hmm. Where the second that I put a frame of an attack into that box, if I'm occupying that space, I'm going to get hit and I'm going to take damage, which is obviously the last thing you want to do in a fighting game.
Yeah.
And so the concept of spacing is the idea of moving in and out of that sphere of influence that your opponent has, getting the damage that you can get in right now, and then immediately getting back out of their sphere of influence. So I think that's kind of what he's talking about when he says that the second that you get too emotionally involved and you let your emotions take over the way that you're going to play, if you're not looking at it in an academic way, then you're going to put yourself into bad situation, into another bad situation, and it kind of becomes like quicksand. You make one mistake, it leads to another, and before you know it, the game's over and I've won.
That makes sense. Because that's how I generally am. I'm a very, I wear my emotions on my sleeve in real mm-hmm. life, so when I'm playing a game, it's the same thing. Like, I just, at the time of this recording last night, I was streaming and I beat Celeste on stream. But I was getting so mad and so worked up about it. Thank you. I was getting so mad and so worked up about it. And I know if I were to play any fighting game, that's exactly how I would be. The difference is that platforming games, like 2D platforming games, I have a lot more patience for. I find those types of games really fun, and it really gets me to want to keep trying, especially if it's a well-designed 2D platformer, because sometimes if it's too punishing, it makes you start back too far, then it's different. But Celeste is nice because it respawns you like less than a second later on the same screen. But with like fighting games, it's hard for me to learn from my mistakes because I don't understand what mistakes I'm making. Like with a platformer, I can see it clearly, like, okay, this is the mistake I'm making. I need to do this. I need to, you know, jump this way, or I need to dodge that way. But in fighting games, it's a lot harder for me to do that because I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And it's the same reason I have, that's the same reason why I'm not a big fan of the Dark Souls games. Not because I think they're actually bad. It's just that those games are much more, like, you have to be much more mechanically sound in their combat in order to survive.
More punishing if you don't have, if you're not minding your P's and Q's.
Exactly. And always my type of gameplay is like, it's a button masher. Like, I enjoy the act of button mashing. And it's not, that doesn't take skill necessarily. Like, I can do some minor things. Like, I understand, like, some really basic brawler types, like the modern brawler now is pretty much like the new Batman and Spider-Man games, where, you know, you have light attacks and you have heavy attacks, but you don't really have to focus necessarily, and you have a dodge roll, but you don't necessarily have to focus on like when you're doing them so much. It's a, you just can pick and choose. But with all that said, like if you get to pick and choose it, then it makes it a little bit more interesting, and you can, you know, there's some variety to it, but you still have to dodge. So it still requires a little bit of skill of knowing when to dodge and when to attack. But versus fighting games, and to a lighter extent in terms of the technicality, you know, Dark Souls and the From Software games, essentially, you have to really know the mechanics in order to be any kind of successful at it. Like, I can't even beat bots on fighting games. Like, I'm so bad at them. It's just,
Well, that's a little bit of a different situation, because depending on the difficulty that you put them at, the reason why bots are really good in in fighting games just in general is that they're reading your movements before they even come out.
Because I remember when I took game design courses, the whole trick, one of the toughest things in game design is programming AI. It's because you have to program the game that knows what you're doing to pretend like it doesn't know what you're doing. And it's just such a weird concept to grasp around. So you have to be really careful with how you design AI. And it's obviously especially important for fighting games. With all that said, though, we've kind of talked, I felt like we've dove a good amount into the inner workings of Soul Calibur 2. I do have one more question that's kind of more of a nebulous, like, Soul Calibur in general, like, series question, but is there anything that we didn't talk about Soul Calibur 2 that you wanted to? Anything that we didn't get to talk about yet?
There is the important note that something that they kind of went away from in later versions of Soul Calibur is the fact that in Soul Calibur 2, you could unlock different weapons for every single person. Now, there are still different weapons in the Create a Soul version of Soul Calibur 6 and 5 and stuff like that, but they're just purely cosmetic. In Soul Calibur 2, they legitimately did different things. There would be swords that would be, like, directly more powerful than other versions. They would either have higher defensive power or higher offensive power, and most importantly, every single character, if you got all of their weapons, would have a version of Soul Edge, but their own version, like, their weapon style, that would be ridiculously powerful. Combos that did a certain amount of damage would now do 2-3 times as much, but also it would slowly zap at your health. Like, you would just be slowly getting your health drained as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I really liked is that every single character got a joke weapon as well.
Okay.
So, for instance, Link would have, like, a version of Soul Edge, but also would have, like, the Master Sword and stuff like that, right? But could also have a joke weapon of, like, his sword is now, like, his fishing net.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, is probably one of my favorites that stayed around, is that Nightmare normally has that gigantic Soul Edge, but now it's still that big of a sword, but now it's like an oar from like a boat.
Mm-hmm.
and it has like different sound effects that it interacts with and everything. And so that was another addition that they had in Soul Calibur 2.
All right, yeah, because that was one of the things I do remember from watching the long play of it, with those different upgraded weapons. In fact, the one they switched to, he played he or she played a lot as, I think, Nightmare, because they had the messed up arm, like the really gross looking arm, but they upgraded a different weapon. All of a sudden, that was taking out large chunks of the bot's the bot's health. So
not a big surprise.
So my last question for you is, like I said, it's kind of more of like an all-encompassing Soul Calibur series thing. What is your personal favorite in the series, and why do you like it more than the others?
Whew. That is very, very tough. One could even argue that it is impossible, because I like different versions of the game for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a child, I played Soul Calibur 2 the most. One could even argue that Soul Calibur 2, inadvertently, when I was a young kid, was what really taught me the basics of fighting games at a very carnal, you know, core level. The concept of, if I hit with this move, my opponent is always going to be on this part of the stage, he's going to be pushed back this amount, and there's going to be this amount of damage that's involved. There's a lot of mathematical... So this is where it become wholeheartedly different than a real fight, in the sense of whether my character that I'm playing is at 100% life, meaning he hasn't been touched, or he is one hit away from dead. If I press this particular combination of buttons, it's going to be an attack that my character is going to throw out at the exact same time as if he had been at full life, the exact same speed, it's going to do the exact same damage. What I guess I mean to say is that morality, like in terms of like your overall morale in a fight, is not important. As it would be in a real fight. Because if I don't think that this move that I'm about to do is going to hit, it's still going to come out at the exact same speed, it's still going to hit the exact same amount, the opponent's going to react the exact same way to it if they get hit by it. And this kind of let me understand the rhythm of fighting games. One move leads into this move, which leads into this setup, which gives me that, this, and the other thing. And Soul Calibur 2 also was the first thing that gave me an introduction to spacing. Right? The concept that I was talking about before. It allowed me to understand just through movement and through just spatial awareness that this was something that you could use to your advantage. It got you away from the button mashy kind of idea that I was using when I was younger and allowed me to understand the next level of a fighting game. So where it all kind of started with me and why I mentioned Soul Calibur 2 to you when you initially had talked about this whole PS2 celebration thing is because of that. Because it was such a, and is, such an important part of my life. Becoming a fighting game player is the thing that I've invested as much of my life into as I possibly could. More than college, more than my job, and you know how much I work hard at my job.
Yes, I do.
It is, and it has meant the world to me. Now, on top of that, I played Soul Calibur 3 for a good amount, but then also Soul Calibur 4 is when I first got into the competitive scene. Mm-hmm. It will always hold a special place in my heart because of that. Because without it, there's a huge chunk of people in my social circle that I wouldn't have known. There's this community of people that support me in my Twitch channel, on Twitter, that interact with me, ask me for advice, my YouTube channel, all that kind of stuff that I enjoy giving back to. That sounds a little pompous, but in the sense of the amount of knowledge that I've accrued over this decade plus of time that I've been playing in fighting games, it is legitimately very rewarding to have people interested in that information that I've accrued, and that I have the forum and the platform to share it. And it all started with Soul Calibur 4. Soul Calibur 5 started in 2012, and it went up to 2018, I think. And so you're talking about a long time to play one game that did not get, that got patched like once in late 2012, and then it was the exact same game for the rest of the time that
wow.
it was out. Yeah. So Namco, and it also is important to note, just as a tidbit, so Soul Calibur 5 is effectively an incomplete game. Because it came out and was being developed during that, if you might remember, in 2012 in Japan, that was during that tsunami that also had, like, the nuclear fallout, like, the radiation, the biggest disaster, and the most, I believe, still the most expensive natural disaster in all of human history, in terms of the sheer amount of destruction that was involved. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is because it is so very clear that Soul Calibur 5 was an unfinished game. It had a handful of interesting, but for instance, the story mode would have like these effectively like these cutscenes, but they were storyboards instead of actual legitimate cutscenes. If you were to look at the very bottom of the character select screen, it is tons of mimic characters, meaning they just mimic other characters' fighting styles, and it's like, you know, that if they actually had the amount of time to complete the game, the bottom of the character select screen was not supposed to look like that.
Yeah.
So it definitely had its faults, and to be playing it for as long as I played it, but it's also how I got like a name for myself in the Soul Calibur community. So I can't really bash it all that hard, because again, all of these games have different sentimental value to me. So probably if I had to choose, man, oh man. Soul Calibur 2 is probably, pound for pound, the best fighting game, but it's also not one that I played competitively. I was too young, and I wasn't aware of a competitive scene before that, because that's like pre-YouTube, pre-anything. So I'd probably have to go with Soul Calibur 5. It's the one that I played the most. It's one of the ones that I find to be the best of the iterations. Soul Calibur 4 is where I started, but especially now that I've seen what a fighting game can be, it's pretty obvious that Soul Calibur 4 was actually pretty bad in terms of a competitive fighting game. It was very, very slow. It had the most powerful Soul Calibur character in competitive history. It also had the weakest character in Soul Calibur history. So very imbalanced. If you wanted to play certain characters in that game competitively, you were just wasting your time. You wouldn't be able to compete at a high level.
Meanwhile, that's disappointing.
Yeah, and two of the characters were effectively banned from tournaments.
Probably the weakest and the strongest.
Well, I mean, there's no reason to ban the weakest, because if the weakest hey, if you want to play this guy, have at it. You're not going to win. But the two strongest characters, one of them in particular, were banned from competitive play, I believe, right after EVO, which is considered the biggest fighting game tournament of the year every year.
That got canceled, unfortunately, this year, right?
Not technically canceled. They're going to be doing it online.
Oof. That's going to be rough.
Hey, it's going to be really rough. But what a lot of the fighting game people are talking about is that they really hope, and I agree with this, I don't think it's going to happen, but I agree with this sentimentality. This is going to allow the developers who make these games to realize and have it demonstrated to the biggest audience possible that their games online are terrible, that they drop out all the time. And they're laggy to the point of being unplayable. And all the sponsors and everything and all the viewers are going to be watching this and showing like, yeah, you guys should get your act together and make these games actually good and playable online. What do you say? Like, it's possible. There are games that do this.
I would hope they would correct all that.
I am a pessimist, so I don't think it's going to happen. But I hold out that I am wrong, and I very much do not mind being wrong, especially on something like this. So I hope it ends up happening. But, EVO's going to be... I'm probably not going to play, just because that's a very frustrating experience to be playing online against somebody in, like, California or whatever, and there's just no way I can do any of the things that I want to do or react as quickly as I can in an offline environment. So what I'm going to try to do is heavily campaign for being a commentator for Evolution. Really hoping I'm going to be able to do that, but it is a lot of politics. It is who you know, so I'm not going to hold my breath, but that's what I'm going to try to do.
If you get that, man, let me know. I will watch anything that you commentate over.
Aw. Well, I'll cross my fingers. Well, I'll cross my fingers, and then I will cross those fingers upon my other fingers.
Cross your toes, cross your fingers, cross your... never mind.
Cross my eyes. Okay.
I told you this the last time we recorded, like, you know, 2 years ago or whatever, but you are... The way that you speak... In general, like, you're very concise and you're very clear. Like, I fumble through my words a lot. I say ums and ahs and I drop likes because I'm constantly trying to figure out what the hell I want to say next. And through podcasting, I've gotten a little bit better at it. And, like, right now, I'm being very conscious of what I'm saying, even though I just dropped a like back there. but whenever I've listened to you speak, whether it's on the podcast or when we've hung out in person, you're very clear and concise. So I love having you on because you can relay all the information that you're trying to relay very clearly, very concisely. And most importantly, it's not... short, if that makes sense. You're not being...
I'm not giving you a soundbite. I'm exactly. giving you what would at the very least appear to be a genuine opinion that I have.
Exactly. You're actually having a conversation with me about it, not just, all right, do you like this game? Yeah, I like it. And then that's it. That's
one
also
could
clear
even
and concise.
Argue that a large portion of this is because having my voice recorded and for to have people listen to it later on doesn't really make me all that nervous, which the more time that I spend on these kinds of things, I'm realizing is not necessarily the case with a lot of other people.
It's true. A lot of people are very nervous when on podcasts and stuff like that. I've had a couple friends on that I've had to, I just remember after they would leave, I was like, oh my God, this isn't as good as I remember it, as I was hoping it would be. But it turns out it was actually better than I expected when I would listen back to it. There was like one I remember where I was like, oh, that didn't go well. And then I listened back while editing. I'm like, oh shit, that was actually a pretty decent episode. But like, but with you, I've never had that. I really enjoy having you on, and you're an excellent guest. So thank you for joining me on this Soul Calibur 2 episode.
Thank you for having me. If you end up talking about a different Soul Calibur game, if you end up talking about fighting games in general, it's something that I talk about all the time, and I never grow tired of it.
I will have to have you on. I'm gonna have to have like a fighting game roundtable. I have two other friends who have been on the show before. Casey, who does Mario Month with me, mm-hmm. He's a Tekken guy. He's okay. Huge into Tekken. And then my friend Andrew, who's been on numerous times, he's did my Donkey Kong 64 episode. Excuse me. He's done, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on, he was on another big episode with me somewhat recently. Our Final Fantasy VII characters ranked. He was on
that
one as
well. Oh, I remember
you
talking about that, yeah.
And he is a Mortal Kombat fan, he doesn't compete or anything like that, but he's very good at it. Like he would cool. be, I don't know how he would do in a competition. Like whenever there's, you know, there's more casual competitions or at anything, yeah. He usually wins those. So right. Who knows what he would do in like one where there's actually like a prize pool, but he's very good at that. Same with Casey. Like Casey's really, really good at Tekken. So I would love to have like a fighting round table where you have Soul Calibur, Tekken, and Mortal Kombat. I just need to find someone who's like an excellent Street Fighter player, then we'd be set.
Yeah, I doubt that would be hard to come by, especially during this time when nobody can really do anything.
Oh my God, and I could actually record. So my setup at home to record, I only have 4 mic inputs, so that would be like, we would be missing the Street Fighter one if that was the case. But if I can record it all online and we do something like this where we're talking over Discord and just all recording uh-huh. separately, that could totally work.
That's really the way that you want to go about it, because getting people, so when you had mentioned trying to find like a good Street Fighter guy, I mean, I know Street Fighter guys, and I can give you some of the best players in New York, but if you want to do this face-to-face, yeah, that's going to be...
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
The coordination right alone is going to be pretty tough. Well, even outside of this crisis that we're going through, like, that, the coordination of that is going to be pretty tough. You need it to be a little bit more convenient than that.
No, it makes sense, but... All right, so, Jay, once again, thank you for coming onto the podcast. Where can the good people find you online?
You guys can find me at Twitch, Sinbad, SINBBAD. If you're interested in seeing competitive Soul Calibur 6 play, that's definitely a place to go. You can also find me on Twitter, JJJ_SC6.
And then as for me, as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod. On all of them, you can email me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do it a number of ways. You could... Something that's easy for you all, it just takes a moment of your time, just give it a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That does help the show gain exposure and helps more people find it. And if you feel so inclined, you can check out my Patreon, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Also check out the network I'm a part of, podbeardnetwork.com. You can check out all the shows that are a part of the network. And probably the most important thing I always like to plug is the nonprofit organization I'm partnered with. It is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care in hospitals. You can check out their website, bitbybitfoundation.org, and consider donating. And that's all the plugs I got. So, Jay, once again, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you tonight. And, yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
And with all that said, I will see you all next time.